This is Audible.
Becoming Supernatural. How Common People Are Doing the Uncommon. By New York Times best-selling author Dr. Joe Dispenza. Read by Adam Boyce.
Before you begin, the diagrams referred to in this book have been made available for you to download at www.drjoedispenza.com/BSN.
Introduction. Getting ready to become supernatural. I realize that writing this book is a risk for me and my reputation. There are certain people in the world, including some in the scientific community, who might call my work pseudoscience, especially after Becoming Supernatural makes its debut. I used to be overly concerned about those critics' opinions. In the early days of my career, I always wrote with skeptics in mind, trying to make sure that they would approve of my work. On some level, I thought it was important to be accepted by that community. But one day, when I was standing in front of an audience in London, and a woman holding the microphone was telling her story about how she overcame her disease, how she healed herself through the practices I've written about in other books, I had an epiphany. It became very clear that those skeptics and rigid scientists who hold their own beliefs about what is possible aren't going to like me or my work no matter what I do. Once I had that realization, I knew that I'd been wasting a lot of my vital energy. I was no longer interested in convincing that particular culture, especially those studying the normal and natural, about human potential. I was totally passionate about anything but normal, and I wanted to study the supernatural. I got very clear that I should give up my futile efforts to convince that community of anything, and instead direct my energy to a whole other part of the population that does believe in possibility and does want to listen to what I have to share. What a relief it was to fully embrace that idea and to let go of any attempt to make a difference in that other world. As I listened to the sweet lady in London, who wasn't a monk or a nun or an academic or a scholar, I knew that in telling her story to the audience, she was helping others see some part of themselves in her. Those hearing her journey might then believe it would be possible for them to accomplish the same. I'm at that point in my life where I am okay with people saying anything about me, and I certainly do have my flaws. But I now know, more than ever, that I am making a difference in people's lives. I say that with utter humility. I have labored for years in taking complex scientific information and making it simple enough for people to apply to their lives. In fact, in the last 4 years, my team of researchers, my staff, and I have gone through extensive strides to scientifically measure, record, and analyze these transformations in people's biology, to prove to the world that common people can do the uncommon. This book is about more than just healing, although it includes stories of people who have made significant changes in their health and have actually reversed diseases, along with the tools you'll need to do the same. These accomplishments are becoming quite common in our community of students. The material you are about to read lives outside of convention and is not usually seen or understood by most of the world. The content of this book is based on an evolution of teachings and practices that have culminated in our students' ability to delve deeper into the more mystical of these. And of course, I'm hoping it will bridge the world of science with the world of mysticism. I wrote this book to take what I've always thought was possible to the next level of understanding. I wanted to demonstrate to the world that we can create better lives for ourselves, and that we are not linear beings living linear lives, but dimensional beings living dimensional lives. Hopefully, reading it will help you understand that you already have all the anatomy, chemistry, and physiology you need to become supernatural, sitting latent within you, waiting to be awakened and activated. In the past, I hesitated to talk about this realm of reality because I feared it might divide an audience based on their own personal beliefs. However, I have wanted to write this book for a long time now. Over the years, I have had profoundly rich mystical experiences that have changed me forever. Those inner events have influenced who I am today. I want to introduce you to that world of dimension and show you some of the measurements we took and the studies we did in our advanced workshops around the world. I started collecting data on our students in these workshops because we witnessed significant changes in their health, and I knew they were changing their biology during the meditations in real time. We have thousands and thousands of brain scans that prove those changes were not just imagined in the minds, but actually took place in their brains. Several of the students we measured accomplished those changes within 4 days, the length of our advanced workshops. The scientific teams I've assembled have taken brain scan recordings using quantitative electroencephalogram EEG measurements before and after workshops, as well as real-time measurements during the meditations and practices themselves. I was not only impressed with the changes, but shocked by them. They were that dramatic. The brains of our students function in a more synchronized and coherent fashion after participating in the advanced retreats around the world. This increased order in their nervous systems helps them get very clear about a future they can create, and they are able to hold that intention independent of the conditions in their external environment. And when their brains are working right, they are working right. I will present scientific data that shows how much their brains improved in just a few days, which means you can do the same for your brain. At the end of 2013, something mysterious started occurring. We started seeing brain scan recordings that puzzled the researchers and neuroscientists who came to our events to study my work. The high amount of energy in the brain that we were recording while a student was in certain meditations had never been recorded up until this point. And yet, we were seeing these off-the-charts readings again and again. When we interviewed the participants, they reported that their subjective experience during the meditation was very real and mystical, and that this either profoundly changed their view of the world or dramatically improved their health. I knew in those moments that these participants were having transcendental experiences in their inner world of meditation that were more real than anything they had ever experienced in their outer world. And we were capturing those subjective experiences objectively. That has become a new normal for us now, and as a matter of fact, we can often predict when these high amplitudes of energy in the brain will occur based on certain indicators and signs that we have seen for years now. In these pages, I want to demystify what it is to have an interdimensional experience, as well as provide the science, biology, and chemistry of the organs, systems, and neurotransmitters that make this happen. It is my hope that this information will give you a roadmap for how to create such experiences for yourself. We have also recorded amazing changes in heart rate variability, HRV. That's when we know a student is opening their heart and maintaining elevated emotions like gratitude, inspiration, joy, kindness, appreciation, and compassion, which cause the heart to beat in a coherent fashion. That is, with rhythm, order, and balance. We know that it takes a clear intention, a coherent brain, and an elevated emotion, a coherent heart, to begin to change a person's biology from living in the past to living in the future. That combination of mind and body, of thoughts and feelings, also seems to influence matter. And that's how you create reality. So if you are going to truly believe in a future that you are imagining with all of your heart, let's make sure it's open and fully activated. Why not, through practice and quantitative feedback, get good at doing it and make it a skill? So we partnered with the HeartMath Institute, HMI, a sharp group of researchers based in Boulder Creek, California, who helped us measure the responses of thousands of our participants. It is our desire for our students to develop the ability to regulate an internal state independent of the conditions in their external environment and to know when they are creating heart coherence and when they are not. In other words, when we measure those internal changes, we can tell a person that they created a more balanced pattern in the heart measurement and that they are doing a great job and should keep doing exactly what they're doing. Or we can let them know that they are not making any biological changes and then give them the proper instruction and provide several opportunities to practice getting better at the process. That's what feedback does. It helps us know when we are doing something correctly and when we aren't. When we can change some feeling or thought inside of us, we can see changes outside of us. And when we observe that we did it correctly, we will pay attention to what we did and do it again. That action creates a constructive habit. By demonstrating how others perform such feats, I want to show you how powerful you can be. Our students know how to influence the autonomic nervous system, ANS. The system that maintains health and balance by automatically taking care of all of our bodily functions while we have the free will to live our lives. It is this subconscious system that gives us our health and gives life to our bodies. Once we know how to gain access to this system, we can not only make our health better, but we can also transform unwanted, self-limiting behaviors, beliefs, and habits into more productive ones. I'll present some of the data we have been collecting for years. We've also taught our students that when they can create heart coherence, their hearts create a measurable magnetic field that projects beyond their body. That magnetic field is an energy, and that energy is a frequency, and all frequency carries information. The information carried on that frequency can be an intention or thought that can influence the heart of another person at a different location, by moving it into coherence and balance. I will show you evidence that a group of people sitting in a room together can influence others sitting at some distance in the same room to go into heart coherence at the exact same time. The evidence clearly shows that we are bound by an invisible field of light and information that influences us and others. Given that, imagine what can happen when we all do this at the same time to change the world. That's exactly what we're up to as a community of individuals who are passionate about making a difference in the future of this earth and the people and other life forms that inhabit it. We have created Project Coherence, in which thousands of people come together at the exact same time on the exact same day to increase the frequency of this planet and of everyone who lives here. Sound impossible? Not at all. More than 23 peer-reviewed articles and more than 50 peace-gathering projects show that such events can lower incidents of violence, war, crime, and traffic accidents, and at the same time increase economic growth. My wish is to show you the science of how you can contribute to changing the world. We have also measured the energy in the room during our workshops and watched how it changes when you have a community of 550 to 1,500 people raising their energy together and creating heart and brain coherence. We have seen significant changes time and time again. Although the instrument we use to measure this is not approved by the scientific community in the United States, it has been acknowledged in other countries, including Russia. In every event, we're wonderfully surprised by the amount of energy certain groups have been able to demonstrate. We have also assessed the invisible field of vital energy surrounding the body of thousands of students to determine whether they can increase their own light field. After all, everything in our material universe is always emitting light and information, including you. When you are living in survival mode under the burden of the hormones of stress, such as adrenaline, you draw from this invisible field of energy and turn it into chemistry, and as you do so, the field around your body shrinks. We discovered a very advanced piece of equipment that can measure the emission of photons, particles of light, to determine whether a person is building a field of light around them or diminishing their own light field. When more light is emitted, there's more energy, and hence more life. When a person has less light and information surrounding their body, they are more matter and thus emit less vital energy. Extensive research proves that the body's cells and various systems communicate not only by the chemical interactions we are familiar with, but also by a field of coherent energy, light, that carries a message, information, that causes the environment within and all around the cell to give instructions to other cells and biological systems. We've measured the amount of vital energy that our students' bodies emit because of the inward changes they've made during our meditations, and I want to show you what changes they can create in only 4 days or less. Other centers in your body besides the heart are also under the control of the autonomic nervous system. I call them energy centers. Each has its own frequency, its own intent or consciousness, its own glands, its own hormones, its own chemistry, its own individual little brain, and so its own unique mind. You can influence these centers to function in a more balanced and integrated fashion. But to do that, you must first learn how to change your brainwaves so you can enter this subconscious operating system. In fact, moving from beta brainwaves, where the thinking brain is constantly analyzing and putting much attention on the outer world, to alpha brainwaves, which indicates you're calmly placing more attention on the inner world, is key. By consciously slowing your brainwaves down, you can more readily program the autonomic nervous system. Students who have done my various meditation practices over the years have learned how to change their brainwaves as well as sharpen the type of focus it takes to be present long enough to produce measurable effects. We've discovered an instrument that can measure those changes, and again, I'll show you some of the research. We've also measured several different biological markers related to changing gene expression, a process known as making epigenetic changes. In this book, you will learn that you are not, in fact, beholden to your genes, and that gene expression is changeable once you begin to think, act, and feel differently. During our events, students leave their familiar lives for 4 to 5 days to instead spend time in an environment that doesn't remind them of who they think they are. In doing so, they separate themselves from the people they know, the things they own, the automatic behaviors they demonstrate in their daily lives, and the places they routinely go, and they begin to change their inner states through 4 different types of meditations: walking, sitting, standing, and lying down. And through each one of these, they learn to become someone else. We know it's true because our studies show significant changes in our students' gene expression, and they've then reported significant changes in their health. Once we can show someone measurable results proving they truly have altered neurotransmitters, hormones, genes, proteins, and enzymes through thought alone, they can better justify their efforts and prove to themselves that they really are transforming. As I share these ideas with you in this book, walking you through the process and explaining the science behind the work that we're doing and why, you'll be learning a lot of fairly detailed information. But don't worry, I will review certain key concepts in different chapters. I do this intentionally to remind you of what you have already learned, so we can build a bigger model of understanding in that moment. At times, the material I present may be challenging. Because I've taught this material to audiences for years, I know it can be a lot. I'll be reviewing and reminding you of what you've learned, so you do not have to go back in the book to search for the information, although you can always review the earlier chapters if you feel you need to. Of course, all of this information will prime you for your own personal transformation. So the better you can wrap your mind around these concepts, the more easily you can surrender to the meditations at the end of most of the chapters, using them as tools to have your own personal experience. In Chapter 1, I tell 3 stories that will give you a basic understanding of what it means to become supernatural. In the first story, you'll meet a woman named Anna, who developed several serious health conditions because of a trauma that kept her anchored to the past. The emotions of stress triggered her genes, and the corresponding hormones created some very challenging health conditions for her. It is a very tough tale. I intentionally chose this story and included it in all its details because I wanted to demonstrate to you that no matter how bad things can get, you have the power to change them, just as this amazing woman did. She applied many of the meditations in this book to modify her personality and heal herself. To me, she is a living example of truth. But she's not the only one who has kept overcoming herself on a daily basis until she became someone else. She joins a whole student body of participants who have done the same, and if they can do it, so can you. I also share two of my own personal stories here, experiences that have changed me at a very deep level. This book is as much about the mystical as it is about healing and creating new opportunities in our lives. I share these stories because I want to prime you for what is possible when we leave this realm of space-time, the Newtonian world we learned about in high school science class, and activate our pineal gland so we can move into the realm of time-space, the quantum world. Many of our students have had similar mystical and interdimensional experiences, which seemed as real as this material reality. Because the second half of the book delves into the physics, neuroscience, neuroendocrinology, and even genetics of how this happens, I hope these stories will pique your curiosity, acting as teasers to open your mind to what's possible. There's a future you, a you who already exists in the eternal present moment, who is actually calling himself or herself to the more familiar you who is reading this book. And that future you is more loving, more evolved, more conscious, more present, more kind, more exuberant, more mindful, more willful, more connected, more supernatural, and more whole. That is who is waiting for you to change your energy to match his or her energy on a daily basis so you can find that future you, who actually exists in the eternal now. Chapter 2 covers one of my favorite topics. I wrote it so you could fully comprehend what it means to be in the present moment. Since all potentials in the fifth dimension, known as the quantum, or the unified field, exist in the eternal present moment, the only way you can create a new life, heal your body, or change your predictable future, is to get beyond yourself. This elegant moment, which we have witnessed in thousands of brain scans, arrives when a person finally surrenders the memory of themselves for something greater. So many people spend the majority of their lives unconsciously choosing to live by the same routines on a regular basis, or they automatically romance their past, feeling the same way every day. As a result, they program their brain and body to be in a predictable future or a familiar past, never living in the present moment. It takes practice to get there, but it's always worth the effort. Finally, finding the sweet spot of the generous present moment is going to require you to exercise a will that is greater than any of your automatic programs, but I'll encourage you every step of the way. The chapter starts off with a basic review of some scientific principles so that we can establish a common terminology to develop models of understanding throughout the book. I'm going to make it pretty simple. Talking about brain function, that is the mind, nerve cells and networks, different parts of the nervous system, chemicals, emotions and stress, brain waves, attention and energy, and a few other subjects is necessary to get you to where you want to go. I have to establish the language to explain why we are doing what we are doing before I teach you how to do it in the meditations that appear throughout the book. If you want more explicit, in-depth information, I invite you to read any of my previous books, including Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, and You Are the Placebo. Chapter 3 is your introduction to the quantum world, the fifth dimension. I want you to understand that there is an invisible field of energy and information that exists beyond this three-dimensional realm of space and time, and that we have access to it. In fact, once you are in the present moment and you've entered this realm, which exists beyond your senses, you are now ready to create your intended reality. When you can take all your attention off your body, the people in your life, the objects you own, the places you go, and even time itself, you will literally forget about your identity that has been formed by living as a body in this space and time. It is in this moment that you, as pure consciousness, enter the realm called the quantum field, which exists beyond this space and time. You can't enter this immaterial place with your problems, your name, your schedules and routines, your pain or your emotions. You can't enter as somebody. You must enter as nobody. In fact, once you know how to move your awareness from the known, the material physical world, to the unknown, the immaterial world of possibility, and you become comfortable there, you can change your energy to match the frequency of any potential in the quantum field that already exists there. Spoiler alert! Actually, all potential futures exist there, so you can create whatever you want. When a vibrational match occurs between your energy and the energy of that potential you select in the unified field, you will draw that experience to you. I'll show you how it all works. Chapter 3 ends with a brief description of a meditation I have developed to help give you an actual experience of the quantum. Each of the teaching chapters from this point on will also end with a brief description of a different meditation. If you want to follow along as I guide you, you can purchase a CD or download an audio recording from any of these meditations from my website, drjoedispenza.com. Of course, you can also opt to try any of the meditations in this book on your own without listening to a recording. For this purpose, I have made free detailed descriptions available, giving the steps of each of these meditations on my website at drjoedispenza.com/BSN meditations. If you are meditating on your own, I recommend you listen to music while you do so. The best type of music is without vocals, and I prefer slow and trancing. It's best to use music that stops you from thinking and that doesn't evoke past memories. You'll find a suggested music list on my website mentioned earlier. In Chapter 4, I introduce you to one of the most popular meditations in our community. It's called the Blessing of the Energy Centers. Each center is under the control of the autonomic nervous system. I will give you the science of how you can program these centers for health and the greatest good during a meditation. If you have been doing my introductory level meditations where you have been placing your attention on different parts of your body and the space around your body, I want you to know that all of your training was for this meditation. Practicing that has helped you sharpen your skill to focus your attention and change your brainwaves so you can enter the operating system of the autonomic nervous system. Once you are there, you can program the operating system with the right orders to heal you, balance your health, and improve your energy and your life. In Chapter 5, I introduce you to a breath that we use at the start of many of our meditations. This breath enables you to change your energy, run an electrical current through your body, and create a more powerful electromagnetic field around you. As I will explain, most people's energy is stored in the body because they have conditioned their body to become the mind from years of thinking, acting, and feeling the same way. It is this process, relating to living in survival mode, that causes most of the creative energy to be rooted in the body. Therefore, we must have a way to pull that energy out of the body and deliver it back to the brain, where it'll be available for a higher purpose than mere survival. I'll give you the physiology of the breath so you can put more intention behind it when you begin to free yourself from the past. Once you start to liberate all that energy back into the brain, then you will learn how to recondition your body to a new mind. I'm going to show you how to teach your body emotionally how to live in the future present reality, instead of the past-present reality where we spend most of our time. Science tells us that the environment signals the gene. Since emotions are the chemical end products of experiences in our environment, when you embrace the elevated emotions in your meditations, you will not only raise your body's energy, but you will also start to signal new genes in new ways, ahead of the environment. There's nothing like a good story or two, In chapter 6, I give you a few examples of students who applied themselves to the meditations in the previous chapters. These case histories should serve as teaching tools to help you fully understand the material I have presented so far. Most of the people you will read about are no different from you. They're common people who have done the uncommon. Another reason I share these stories is so you can personally relate to these people. Once you have the thought, if they can do it, so can I, you will naturally believe in yourself more. I always tell our community, when you choose to prove to yourself how powerful you really are, you have no idea who you will be helping in the future. These people are proof that it's possible for you. In chapter 7, I introduce what it means to create heart coherence. Like brain coherence, the heart functions in the same organized way when we are truly present, when we can sustain elevated emotional states, and when we feel safe enough to fully open up to possibility. The brain thinks, but the heart knows. This is the center of oneness, wholeness, and unity consciousness. It is where opposites meet, representing the union of polarities. Think of this center as your connection to the unified field. When it is activated, you go from selfish states to selfless states. When you can maintain internal states independent of conditions in your external environment, you are mastering your environment. It takes practice to get good at keeping your heart open, and if you do, it will keep beating longer. Chapter 8 shares one of the other favorite activities we do at our advanced workshops, combining a kaleidoscope with videos called mind movies that our students make of their future. We use the kaleidoscope to induce a trance because when you're in trance, you are more suggestible to information. Suggestibility is your ability to accept, believe, and surrender to information without any analysis. If you do this properly, it is indeed possible to program your subconscious mind. So it makes sense that when you use the kaleidoscope to change your brainwaves, with your eyes open instead of closed in a meditation, you can lower the volume of the analytical mind to open the door between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. And when you follow that with a mind movie, with scenes of yourself or pictures of what the future you want looks like, you program yourself into that new future. So many of our students have created amazing new lives and opportunities when they took the time to make their mind movie and then watch it with the kaleidoscope. Some students are already on their third mind movie because everything in their first two has already happened. In chapter 9, I introduce the walking meditation. This meditation incorporates both standing and walking. I find this practice such a valuable tool in helping us literally walk into our future. Many times we can have an amazing seated meditation and connect to something bigger than us, but when we open our eyes and come back to our senses, we go unconscious again and return to a series of unconscious programs, emotional reactions, and automatic attitudes. I developed this meditation because I want our community to be able to embody the energy of their future, and do it with their eyes open as well as closed. In time, as you practice this, you might naturally begin to think like a wealthy person, act like an unlimited being, and feel an expansive joy for existence because you installed the circuits and conditioned your body to become that person. Chapter 10 shares another set of case studies to engage your level of understanding with allegory. These fascinating stories will help you connect the dots so you can hear the information from another angle and read about people who have experienced it firsthand. I hope they will inspire you to do your practice with more conviction, certainty, and trust so that you can experience the truth for yourself. Chapter 11 opens your mind to what's possible in the interdimensional world beyond the senses. In quiet moments, I often find my mind drifting to the mystical, one of my favorite topics. I love those transcendental experiences that are so lucid and real that I can never go back to business as usual because I know too much. During those inner events, the level of awareness and energy is so profound that when I come back to my senses and my personality, I often naturally think to myself, I got this all wrong. The this I'm referring to is the way reality really is, not how I've been conditioned to perceive it to be. In this chapter, I take you on a journey from this realm of space-time, where space is eternal, and we experience time as we move through space, to the realm of time-space, where time is eternal, and we experience space, or spaces, or various dimensions, as we move through time. It is going to challenge your very understanding of the nature of reality. All I can say is that if you hang in there, you will get it. It might take you a few readings to fully understand it, but as you study the material and contemplate it, your contemplation builds the circuits in your brain in preparation for the experience. Once you are beyond your associations to this material world and you are in the unified field, chock full of infinite possibilities, biological systems exist for taking that energy that's beyond the vibration of matter and turning it into imagery in the brain. That's where the pineal gland comes in, the subject of chapter 12. Think of your pineal gland, a tiny gland perched in the central back area of your brain, as an antenna that can transduce frequencies and information and turn them into vivid imagery. When you activate your pineal gland, you're going to have a full-on sensory experience without your senses. That eternal event will be more real to you in your mind while your eyes were closed than any past external experience you've ever had. In other words, in order to lose yourself fully in the inward experience, it has to be so real that you are there. When this happens, this little gland transmutes melatonin into some very powerful metabolites that cause you to have that type of experience. We will study the properties of this gland, and then you will learn how to activate it. Chapter 13 introduces you to one of our most recent endeavors, Project Coherence. When we witnessed the measurements of so many of our students going into heart coherence at the exact same time on the exact same day during the exact same meditation, we knew that they were affecting each other non-locally, energetically as opposed to physically. The energy they were emitting in the form of elevated emotions carried their intention that the greatest good happen to everyone gathered in the room. Imagine a large body of people all elevating their energy and then placing the intention on that energy that lives be enriched, bodies be healed, dreams come true, futures be realized, and the mystical become common in our lives. When we saw how our students were able to open the hearts of others, we knew it was time to start doing global meditations to help change the world. Thousands and thousands of people from all over the world have joined in and participated in changing and healing this planet and the people on it. After all, aren't we doing this work to make the world a better place? I'll give you the science of how this all works, and I do mean science. Enough peer-reviewed studies on the power of peace-gathering projects have been published to prove it works. So instead of just studying history, why not make history? The book finishes with chapter 14, which shares some pretty wild case studies of some of the mind-blowing mystical experiences people have had doing this work. Once again, I share them so you can see that even the most mystical adventures can be yours if you work at it. So are you ready to become supernatural? Chapter 1. Opening the Door to the Supernatural. As spring was ending and the first glimpse of summer was approaching, what first appeared to be a typical Sunday afternoon in June 2007 turned out to be anything but typical for Anna Willems. The French doors from the living room to the garden were open wide, and the thin white curtains danced lightly in the breeze as scents from the garden floated inside. Streams of sunlight shone brightly all around Anna as she lounged comfortably. A chorus of birds chirped and trilled outside, and Anna could hear the distant melody of children's laughter and playful splashing coming from a neighbor's swimming pool. Anna's 12-year-old son reclined on the sofa, reading a book, and she could hear her 11-year-old daughter in the room directly above her, singing to herself as she played. A psychotherapist, Anna worked as a manager and board member for a major psychiatric institution in Amsterdam, whose profits totaled more than 10 million euros annually. She often caught up on professional reading on the weekends, and on this day, she was sitting in her red leather chair reading a journal article. Little did Anna know that what looked like the perfect world to anyone peering into her living room that day would become a nightmare within minutes. Anna felt a bit distracted, noticing that her attention wasn't fully engaged in the material she was attempting to study. She set her papers down and paused, suddenly wondering again where her husband had gone. He had left the house early that morning while she was taking a shower. Without saying where he was headed, he had simply disappeared. The children had told her that their father had said goodbye, giving each of them a big hug before he left. She tried to reach him on his cell phone many times, but he hadn't returned her calls. She tried one more time. No answer. Something definitely felt odd. At 3:30 p.m., the doorbell rang, and when Anna opened the front door, she found two police officers standing outside. "Are you Mrs. Willems?" one of them asked. When she confirmed she was indeed Mrs. Willems, the officers asked if they could come in and talk to her. Concerned and a bit confused, she complied. Then they delivered the news. Earlier that morning, her husband had jumped off one of the tallest buildings in the center of the city. Not surprisingly, the fall was fatal. Anna and her two children sat in shock and disbelief. Anna's breath momentarily stopped, and as she then gasped for air, she started to shake uncontrollably. The moment seemed frozen in time. While her children sat paralyzed in shock, Anna tried to hide her pain and stress for their sakes. An intense pain suddenly shot through her head, and she simultaneously felt a deep, hollow ache in her gut. Her neck and shoulders instantly stiffened as her mind frenetically raced from thought to thought. The hormones of stress had overtaken her. Anna was now in survival mode. How stress hormones take over. From a scientific standpoint, living in stress is living in survival. When we perceive a stressful circumstance that threatens us in some way, one for which we cannot predict or control the outcome, a primitive nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system turns on, and the body mobilizes an enormous amount of energy in response to the stressor. Physiologically, the body is automatically tapping into the resources it will need to deal with the current danger. The pupils dilate so we can see better. The heart rate and respiratory rate increase so we can run, fight, or hide. More glucose is released into the bloodstream to make more energy available to our cells. And our blood flow is shunted to the extremities and away from our internal organs so we can move quickly if we need to. The immune system initially dials up and then dials down as adrenaline and cortisol flood the muscles, providing a rush of energy to either escape or fend off the stressor. Circulation moves out of our rational forebrain and is instead relayed to our hindbrain, so we have less capacity to think creatively and instead rely more on our instinct to instantly react. In Anna's case, the stressful news of her husband's suicide threw her brain and body into just such a state of survival. In the short term, all organisms can tolerate adverse conditions by fighting, hiding, or fleeing from an impending stressor. All of us are built for dealing with short-term bursts of stress. When the event is over, the body normally returns to balance within hours, increasing its energy levels and restoring its vital resources. But when the stress doesn't end within hours, the body never returns to balance. In truth, No organism in nature can endure living in emergency mode for extended periods of time. Because of our large brains, human beings are capable of thinking about their problems, reliving past events, or even forecasting future worst-case situations, and thus turning on the cascade of stress chemicals by thought alone. We can knock our brains and bodies out of normal physiology just by thinking about an all-too-familiar past, or trying to control an unpredictable future. Every day, Anna relived that event over and over in her mind. What she didn't realize was that her body did not know the difference between the original event that created the stress response and the memory of the event, which created the same emotions as the real-life experience all over again. Anna was producing the same chemistry in her brain and body as if the event were actually happening again and again. Subsequently, her brain was continuously wiring the event into her memory bank, and her body was emotionally experiencing the same chemicals from the past at least 100 times each day. By repeatedly recalling the experience, she was unintentionally anchoring her brain and body to the past. Emotions are the chemical consequences or feedback of past experiences. As our senses record incoming information from the environment, clusters of neurons organize into networks. When they freeze into a pattern, the brain makes a chemical that is then sent throughout the body. That chemical is called an emotion. We remember events better when we can remember how they feel. The stronger the emotional quotient from any event, either good or bad, the stronger the change in our internal chemistry. When we notice a significant change inside of us, the brain pays attention to whoever or whatever is causing the change outside of us, and it takes a snapshot of the outer experience. That's called a memory. Therefore, the memory of an event can become branded neurologically in the brain, and that scene becomes frozen in time in our gray matter, just as it did for Anna. The combination of various people or objects at a particular time and place from that stressful experience is etched into our neural architecture as a holographic image. That's how we create a long-term memory. Therefore, the experience becomes imprinted in the neural circuitry, and the emotion is stored in the body. And that's how our past becomes our biology. In other words, when we experience a traumatic event, we tend to think neurologically within the circuitry of that experience, and we tend to feel chemically within the boundaries of the emotions from that event. So our entire state of being, how we think and how we feel, becomes biologically stuck in the past. As you can imagine, Anna was feeling a rush of negative emotions, tremendous sadness, pain, victimization, grief, guilt, shame, despair, anger, hatred, frustration, resentment, shock, fear, anxiety, worry, overwhelm, anguish, hopelessness, powerlessness, isolation, loneliness, disbelief, and betrayal. And none of those emotions dissipated quickly. As Anna analyzed her life within the emotions of the past, she kept suffering more and more. Because she couldn't think greater than how she constantly felt, and since emotions are a record of the past, she was thinking in the past, and every day she felt worse. As a psychotherapist, she could rationally and intellectually understand what was happening to her, but all her insights couldn't get beyond her suffering. People in her life started treating her as the person who had lost her husband, and that became her new identity. She associated her memories and feelings with the reason she was in her present state. When anyone asked her why she felt so bad, she told the story of the suicide, each time reliving the pain, anguish, and suffering over again. All along, Anna kept firing the same circuits in her brain and reproducing the same emotions, conditioning her brain and body further into the past. Every day, she was thinking, acting, and feeling as if the past was still alive. And since how we think, how we act, and how we feel is our personality, Anna's personality was completely created by the past. From a biological standpoint, in repeatedly telling the narrative of her husband's suicide, Anna literally couldn't get beyond what had happened. A downward spiral begins. Anna could no longer work and had to take leave of absence. During that time, she found out that her husband, although a successful lawyer, had made a mess of their personal finances. She would have to pay off significant debts that she had previously been unaware of, and she didn't have the money to even begin. Not surprisingly, even more emotional, psychological, and mental stress began to add up. Anna's mind went in circles, constantly flooded with questions. How will I take care of our children? How will all of us deal with this trauma in our future, and how will it affect our lives? Why did my husband leave without saying goodbye to me? How could I not know he was so unhappy? Did I fail as a wife? How could he leave me with two young children, and how will I manage to raise them by myself? Then judgments crept into her thoughts. He shouldn't have committed suicide and left me in this financial mess. What a coward. How dare he leave his children without a father? He didn't even write a message for the children and me. I hate him for not even leaving a note. What a jerk to leave me and make me raise these kids alone. Did he have any idea what this might do to us? All of these thoughts carried a strong emotional charge, further affecting her body. 9 months later, on March 21st, 2008, Anna woke up paralyzed from the waist down. Within hours, she was lying in a hospital bed, a wheelchair beside her, diagnosed with neuritis, inflammation of the peripheral nervous system. After several tests, the doctors could not find anything structural as the cause of the problem, so they told Anna that she must have an autoimmune condition. Her immune system was attacking the nervous system in her lower spine, breaking down the protective layer that coats the nerves and causing paralysis in both of her legs. She could not hold her urine, had difficulty controlling her bowels, and had no feeling or motor control in her legs and feet. When the fight-or-flight nervous system is switched on and stays on because of chronic stress, the body utilizes all its energy reserves to deal with the constant threat it perceives from the outer environment. Therefore, the body has no energy left in its inner environment for growth and repair, compromising the immune system. So because of her repeated inner conflict, Anna's immune system was attacking her body. She had finally physically manifested the pain and suffering she'd emotionally experiencing in her mind. In short, Anna could not move her body because she wasn't moving forward in her life. She was stuck in her past. For the next 6 weeks, Anna's doctors treated her with huge doses of intravenous dexamethasone and other corticosteroids to reduce inflammation. Because of the added stress and the types of drugs she was taking, which can further weaken the immune system, she also developed an aggressive bacterial infection for which her doctors gave her huge doses of antibiotics. After 2 months, Anna was released from the hospital and had to use a walker and crutches to get around. She still could not feel her left leg and found standing very difficult. She couldn't walk properly. Although she could hold her bowels a bit better, she still couldn't control her urine. As you can imagine, this new situation was adding to Anna's already high stress levels. She had lost her husband to suicide. She could not work very much to support herself and her children. She was in serious financial crisis, and she had been living in the hospital paralyzed for more than 2 months. Her mother had to move in to help. Anna was an emotional, mental, and physical wreck. And although she had the best doctors and the latest medications from a reputable hospital, she was not getting any better. By 2009, 2 years after the death of her husband, she was diagnosed with clinical depression. So she started taking even more medication. Consequently, Anna's mood swung widely from anger to grief to pain to suffering to hopelessness to frustration to fear, to hatred. Because those emotions influenced her actions, her behavior became somewhat irrational. At first, she fought with almost everybody around her except her children, but then she started to have conflicts with her youngest daughter. The Dark Night of the Soul. In the meantime, many more physical problems started showing up, and Anna's journey became even more painful. The mucous membranes in her mouth started to develop large ulcerations that spread into her upper esophagus as the result of another autoimmune disease called erosive lichen planus. To treat it, she had to use corticosteroid ointments in her mouth in addition to more pills. These new medications caused Anna's saliva production to stop. She couldn't eat solid foods, so she lost her appetite. Anna was living with all three types of stress, physical, chemical, and emotional, at the same time. In 2010, Anna found herself in a dysfunctional relationship with a man who traumatized her and her children with verbal abuse, power games, and constant threats. She lost all her money, her job, and her feeling of safety. When she lost her house, she had to move in with her abusive boyfriend. Stress levels continued climbing. Her ulcerations started to spread to other mucous membranes, including her vagina, her anus, and further down her esophagus. Her immune system had totally collapsed, and now she was experiencing several different skin conditions, food allergies, and weight problems. Then she started having problems swallowing and developing heartburn, for which the doctors prescribed still more medications. Anna started a small psychotherapy practice at home in October. She could only handle seeing clients for 2 sessions a day in the morning after her children went to school 3 days a week. In the afternoon, she was so tired and sick that she would lie in bed until her children returned from school. She tried to be there for them as much as possible, but she had no energy and didn't feel well enough to leave the house. Anna hardly saw anyone. She had no social life. All the circumstances in her body and in her life constantly reminded her how bad things were. She automatically reacted to everyone and everything. Her thinking was chaotic and she could not concentrate. She had no vitality or energy to live anymore. Often when she exerted herself, her heart rate exceeded 200 beats per minute. She found herself sweating and gasping for breath all the time, and she felt an enormous pain in her chest on a regular basis. Anna was passing through her darkest night of the soul. Suddenly, she understood why her husband had taken his life. She wasn't sure she could go on anymore and started thinking of committing suicide herself. She thought, it can't get any worse than this. And then it did. In January 2011, Anna's medical team found a tumor near the entrance of her stomach and diagnosed her with esophageal cancer. Of course, this news severely increased Anna's stress levels. The doctors suggested a rigorous course of chemotherapy. No one asked about her emotional and mental stress. They only treated the physical symptoms. But Anna's stress response was fully turned on, and it couldn't turn off. It's amazing how this can happen to so many people. Because of a shock or trauma in their lives, they never get beyond those corresponding emotions, and their health and their lives break down. If an addiction is something that you think you can't stop, then objectively, it looks as though people like Anna become addicted to the very emotions of stress that are making them sick. The rush of adrenaline and the rest of the stress hormones arouses their brain and body, providing a rush of energy. In time, they become addicted to the rush of that chemistry, and then they use the people and conditions in their lives to reaffirm their addiction to the emotion, just to keep feeling that heightened state. Anna was using her stressful conditions to recreate that rush of energy, and without realizing it, she became emotionally addicted to a life she hated. Science tells us that such chronic, long-term stress pushes the genetic buttons that cause disease. So if Anna was turning the stress response on by thinking about her problems and her past, her thoughts were making her sick. And since stress hormones are so powerful, she had become addicted to her own thoughts that were making her feel so bad. Anna agreed to start chemotherapy, but after her first session, she had an emotional and mental breakdown. One afternoon after her kids went to school, Anna collapsed on the floor, crying. She had finally reached the bottom. It occurred to her that if she continued this way, she would not survive for long, and she would leave her children alone without either parent. She started to pray for help. She knew in her heart that something needed to change. In utter sincerity and surrender, she asked for guidance, support, and a way out, promising that if her prayers were answered, she would be thankful and grateful every day for the rest of her life, and she would help others to do the same. Anna's turning point. The choice to change became Anna's quest. She first decided to stop all the treatments and all the medications for her various physical illnesses, although she continued to take her antidepressants. She didn't tell the doctors and nurses that she was not coming back for treatment. She simply did not show up anymore. No one ever called her to ask why. Only her family doctor contacted Anna to express concern. On that cold winter's day in February 2011, when Anna was on the floor crying for help, she made a choice with a firm intention to change herself and her life. And the amplitude of that decision carried a level of energy that caused her body to respond to her mind. It was that decision to change that gave her the strength to rent a house for herself and her children and to move away from the negative relationship she was in. It was as if that moment redefined her. She knew she had to start all over. When I first saw Anna, it was 1 month later. One of the few friends she had left had reserved a seat for Anna at a Friday evening talk that I was giving. Her friend made Anna an offer. If she liked the evening lecture, she could stay for a full 2-day weekend workshop. Anna agreed to go. The first time I saw her, she was sitting in a packed conference room on the left side on the outer aisle, her crutches leaning against the wall near where she sat. As usual, I was carrying on that night about how our thoughts and feelings affect our bodies and our lives. I lectured about how stress chemicals can create disease. I touched on neuroplasticity, psychoneuroimmunology, epigenetics, neuroendocrinology, and even quantum physics. I will go into more detail on all of these later in this book, but for now, it's enough to know that the latest research in these branches of science point to the power of possibility. That night, filled with inspiration, Anna thought, if I created the life I have now, including my paralysis, my depression, my weakened immune system, my ulcerations, and even my cancer, maybe I can uncreate everything with the same passion I created it with. And with that potent new understanding, Anna decided to heal herself. Immediately after her first weekend workshop, she started meditating twice a day. Of course, sitting and doing meditations was difficult at the beginning. She had a lot of doubt to overcome, and some days she did not feel mentally or physically well. But she did her meditations anyway. She also had a lot of fear. When her family doctor called to check up on her because she had stopped her treatments and medications, he told Anna that she was being naive and stupid, and that she would get worse and die soon. Imagine the memory of an authority figure telling you that. Even so, Anna did her meditations every day and began to move beyond her fears. She was often consumed with financial burdens, her children's needs, and various physical limitations, yet she never used those conditions as an excuse to not do her inner work. She even attended 4 more of my workshops during that year. By going within and changing her unconscious thoughts, automatic habits and reflexive emotional states, which had become hardwired in her brain and emotionally conditioned in her body, Anna was now more committed to believing in a new future than believing in her same familiar past. She used her meditations, combining a clear intention with an elevated emotion, to change her state of being from biologically living in the same past to living in a new future. Every day, Anna was unwilling to get up from her meditations as the same person who sat down. She decided that she wouldn't finish until her whole state of being was in love with life. To the materialist, who defines reality with the senses, of course, Anna had no tangible reason to be in love with life. She was a depressed, widowed, single parent who was in financial debt and had no real job. She had cancer and suffered from paralysis and ulcerations in her mucous membranes. And she was in a poor living situation with no partner or significant other and no energy to tend to her children. But in the meditations, Anna learned that she could teach her body emotionally what her future would feel like ahead of the actual experience. Her body, as the unconscious mind, did not know the difference between the real event and the one she was imagining and emotionally embracing. She also knew, through her understanding of epigenetics, that the elevated emotions of love, joy, gratitude, inspiration, compassion, and freedom could signal new genes to make healthy proteins affecting her body's structure and function. She fully understood that if the stress chemicals that had been coursing through her body had been turning on unhealthy genes, then by fully embracing those elevated emotions with a passion greater than the stressful emotions, she could turn on new genes and change her health. For a year, her health didn't change very much. But she kept doing her meditations. In fact, she did all the meditations I designed for students. She knew it had taken several years to create her current health conditions, and so it would take some time to recreate something new. So she kept doing the work, striving to become so conscious of her unconscious thoughts, behaviors, and emotions that she would not let anything she did not want to experience slip by her awareness. After that first year, Anna noticed that she was slowly starting to get better mentally and emotionally. Anna was breaking the habit of being herself, inventing a whole new self instead. Anna knew from attending my workshops that she had to move her autonomic nervous system back into balance, because the ANS controls all the automatic functions that happen beyond the brain's conscious awareness. Digestion, absorption, blood sugar levels, body temperature, hormonal secretions, heart rate, and so on. The only way she could slip into the operating system and affect the ANS was to change her internal state on a regular basis. So first, Anna began each meditation with the blessing of the energy centers. These specific areas of the body are under the control of the ANS. As I mentioned in the introduction, each center has its own energy or frequency, which emits specific information or has its own consciousness, its own glands, its own hormones, its own chemistry, its own individual little mini brain, and therefore its own mind. Each center is influenced by the subconscious brain sitting under our conscious thinking brain. Anna learned how to change her brainwaves so she could enter the operating system of the ANS, located in the midbrain, and reprogram each center to work in a more harmonious manner. Every day, with focus and passion, she rested her attention in each area of her body, as well as the space around each center, blessing it for greater health and the greater good. Slowly but surely, she began to influence her health by reprogramming her autonomic nervous system back to balance. Anna also learned a specific breathing technique I teach in our work to liberate all the emotional energy that is stored in the body when we keep thinking and feeling the same way. By constantly thinking the same thoughts, Anna had been creating the same feelings. And then by feeling those familiar emotions, she would think more of the same corresponding thoughts. She learned that the emotions of the past were stored in her body, but she could use this breathing technique to liberate that stored energy and free herself from her past. So every day, with a level of intensity that was greater than her addiction to past emotions, she practiced the breath and got better and better at doing it. After she learned to move that stored energy in her body, she learned how to recondition her body to a new mind by embracing the heart-centered emotions of her future before her future unfolded. Since Anna also studied the model of epigenetics I teach in our workshops and lectures, she learned that genes don't create disease. Instead, the environment signals the gene to create disease. Anna understood that if her